Oh, we are live in Philadelphia in Studio 2. Welcome, everybody. So glad to have you with us. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg on this beautiful Wednesday afternoon.
We can't see it in the studio.
But it was beautiful coming in.
It was
beautiful coming in today. And Ramadan Mubarak to everyone who celebrates during this holy month of Ramadan, which began this week. And so we're going to, in our newsmaker segment, we're going to talk about one of the big announcements that just came in about Philadelphia's Black Muslim community, including their creation of the Black Muslim Leadership Council. We'll talk about that on the show with the founder, Salima Suswell. Looking forward to that. We're also talking about TikTok, which has been top of mind all day long. The U.S. House, Avi, they voted to ban TikTok today. I mean, we kind of knew it was coming, but I wasn't really sure that they'd go that far. Are you surprised at all?
I have to do a sad dance to work through my feelings and tape it and put it on TikTok. I've never been on TikTok. Full disclosure. But I do find the politics around this fascinating.
And we're going to talk about that with the Washington Post's tech writer, Will Oremus. We'll also talk about what it's like to grow up in public. Our teenagers have a lot of their world happening online. They're every little thing is on social media these days. And how do you help your young person navigate through that? We have the author of Growing Up in Public, Devorah Heitner, on the show, and we're going to be taking questions and calls on that. Yeah. So
We've already got a few spicy comments popping up on our screen, but if you want to join the conversation, studio2@whyy.org is our email address. You can also call us 888-477-9499 and would be especially interested to hear from folks who have teenagers at home.
Yeah. And teens, guess what?
Yeah.
You can use your phone for more than just text.
That's right. And
you can call us.
And you can call us.
888-477-9499. If you're home for today or you're on lunch
break, yeah.
Yeah, you can call us and we'd love to hear your thoughts as well.
And it's not surprising because a lot of teens do listen to NPR during their lunch break at high school.
Absolutely. And we're going to dig into the news. And Avi, you're up first.
Sure.
Today.
And dig is probably a good phrase, a good verb to start off with, because they dug out what became the Vine Street Expressway in the 80s and 90s. And there is now a movement along 676 and other major highways to cap and to, in some ways, you know, heal the damage done by driving these highways through major cities. It's going to be called the Chinatown Stitch here in Philadelphia. And we just heard this week about millions in federal funding that will make this project possible. It will basically cover the Vine Street Expressway between 10th Street and 13th Street, which will help reconnect Chinatown to the neighborhood just to the north of it. And we actually talked about this project with Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg yesterday when he was coming to Philadelphia to celebrate this announcement. And here's what he had to say.
Philadelphia just got a $158 million federal grant for the Chinatown Stitch project construction, righting a decades-long wrong in that community. Why is this project so important? And what message is being sent here?
Well, the Vine Street Expressway and the way that it cuts through Chinatown in Philadelphia is an example of something that has happened in community after community across the country, often in the 50s, 60s, 70s, but sometimes more recently than that, where a major highway construction project tore through a community, often a community of color that might have been one with the least political power to resist or to change that project. Our attention to this is not an exercise in guilt. It's not about wallowing the past. It's about doing something to make it better for the future, especially because federal funds wound up dividing many of these communities. So we think federal funds ought to help stitch them back together. That's what this project represents. As a matter of fact, it's called the Chinatown Stitch because what it's going to do is cap that part of the expressway, creating new land, which is one of the rarest things you ever get in the middle of a city, and crucially, helping that Chinatown neighborhood heal and prosper for the future.
That was Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg talking with us yesterday about the Chinatown Stitch, which is a project to cap the Vine Street Expressway between 10th and 13th Streets in Philadelphia.
Yeah, and the construction will start likely in 2028. So we'll pretty soon start seeing all of these federal funds being put into action. moving on, a federal appeals court says that the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office made some mistakes in one of their efforts to overturn a death sentence. This ruling came out last week from a Third Circuit Court of Appeals panel, and it's all in connection with efforts by DA Larry Krasner's office to vacate the death penalty in the case of Robert Wharton. Now, Wharton was one of two defendants convicted of first-degree murder in the 1984 killing of Bradley and Bernhardt. They were a couple living in Mount Airy. Mm. A few years ago, Wharton appealed his death sentence. He wanted to bump it down to life in prison. Krasner's office supported that appeal. The problem is Wharton claimed that his lawyer failed to present evidence that he was a model prisoner during that time between his arrest and conviction, and that if it had been presented to the jury, he wouldn't have gotten the death penalty. Comes to find out that appeal, some of those facts that were presented in that appeal were misstated. Mm. Krasner's office had basically rubber stamped that, some of the facts that were presented, and the court said that, you know, he made a mistake in doing that, that his office should have done more investigation. That's according to the Pennsylvania Attorney General.
Took his word for it.
Basically took his word for it. Yeah. And they said he should have done more investigation instead of just taking the lawyer's word for it there. A district court has sanctioned the DA's office. They said that he had to apologize to the Hart family, the family of the victims of Wharton, because they were against a life sentence. They wanted him to stay on death row.
To be clear, this was not an exoneration.
No, it was not an exoneration. It was simple to vacate a death sentence, right, and bump it down to life in prison. And so now the DA's office has to apologize. The court said that they, should not. They should have done more investigation here, that they made a mistake in simply rubber stamping what the defendant's lawyer said in this case. But it also gives fodder to critics of DA's office. The DA's office has been able to exonerate about 40 people. They've been trying to bump down some of these death sentences to life in prison because, as you know,
it's a national model.
Yeah. And so this gives fodder to those critics. But this is just one individual case. They said that mistakes were made and that sanctions will remain imposed.
Mistakes in this one case.
In this one case. Okay. Exactly. Okay. It doesn't roll back everything else. It doesn't. But it gives critics fodder to question other cases.
Right, because it centers on an issue that the DA's office under Krasner has become known for and which has drawn tremendous backlash.
A lot of backlash, yes.
Moving now to Wawa. Mm-hmm. A beloved Wawa is closing near the art museum, near the Barnes. 21st and Hamilton Streets, there's been a Wawa there for like since the 80s. And it's closing because, well, the landlord doesn't want them there anymore. They're turning it into a bank. But what's interesting about the end of this Wawa, well, I guess it's interesting because we both went there and we liked this Wawa, that it's the seventh Philly Wawa to close since 2020, according to the Inquirer. So there has been quite a contraction in the city. Mm-hmm. Some of them have been for the purported reasons of lagging sales, retail theft, different cases for different Wawas. But this is not what's going on here. This is just a case where the landlord is saying, we think we can get a better deal from someone else. Sorry, Wawa.
And this was a hot Wawa. And I say that in the sense that every time there was a run near the art museum, that Wawa would be packed because everybody would be going there to get a little shorty after their little 5K or half marathon. So, bye-bye Wawa. And I'm sad to see so many Wawas going.
Wawa's an interesting company, because it's huge and it's still majority owned by the family that started it, the Wood family, which is unusual for such a large company. And it's growing at great speed and scale despite its contraction here in Philadelphia. There was a really interesting story recently in Bloomberg about how Wawa wants to open like 280 stores in the next decade in states like Alabama and Tennessee and Georgia and North Carolina. So sort of your little city convenience store Wawa seems to be going the way of the dinosaur, or sometimes it feels that way.
But it's
spreading. While sort of the big suburban roadside Wawas are, you know, proliferating across the country. It does feel like the brand is changing a little bit.
And their focus, it seems like.
Yeah.
So moving on to our newsmaker, Philadelphia is home to a robust Islamic community, with leaders estimating that the city has about 200,000 Muslim residents. 80%, though, of that population is African-American. And now there's a brand new organization in Philadelphia to advocate on their behalf. It's called the Black Muslim Leadership Council.
With the start of the holy month of Ramadan, we reached out to BMLC founder and CEO Salima Suswell to ask her about the new organization, the issues facing Black Muslims in our city, and the start of Ramadan. And she's here with us now. Salima, welcome to Studio 2.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Well, Ramadan Mubarak to you, Salima. We're going to jump right in. Why did you start the Black Muslim Leadership Council, and what is its purpose?
You know, I started the Black Muslim Leadership Council after, you know, encouragement from some of our community pioneers, actually, nationally. After the 2020 election, there was a lot of conversation around, you know, Black Muslims organizing in terms of civic participation. And really, we felt that there was a void as it relates to advocacy on behalf of African-American community issues. And so the issues that are domestic, that are impacting urban communities, such as healthcare or education, affordable housing. We felt like some of these things were going unrecognized, and we wanted to uplift those things. And I thought it would be great to just start an institution. It's the first institution of its kind where we have a 501c3 arm for engagement and also a 501c4 arm for advocacy. So we're really excited about this new venture.
What do you think people misunderstand about the Black Muslim community in Philadelphia and around the country?
That's a really good question. I don't know if there is necessarily a misunderstanding. Like, I don't know if I would frame it that way. What I have just recognized is that when people think in the mainstream, when folks are thinking of American Muslims, they're thinking of our Arab Muslim brothers and sisters or our South Asian Muslim brothers and sisters, but not necessarily thinking of African Americans as, you know, Muslims or individuals who practice the religion of Islam. And so a lot of times we find synergy with, like, the Black church, because we, you know, are often advocating for needs that are similar based upon, you know, living in the same communities under the same socioeconomic conditions. And so, yeah, I think that more than anything, it's just like sort of, you know, been, I would even say an erasure almost of the fact that Black Muslims even exist. So, again, we just want to uplift our communities.
And I know that Philadelphia is home to 200,000 Muslims, 80% of which are African-American. You know, this is the holy month of Ramadan. What are you doing to celebrate? And sort of like, do you stand in solidarity with all the folks in Gaza who are your Muslim brothers and sisters as well?
Well, we're definitely thinking a lot about our brothers and sisters in Gaza. You know, the humanitarian crisis in Gaza is something that we're all impacted by. There have been over 30,000 lives lost. And not only are we praying for a permanent ceasefire, but we're also praying for the return of hostages that are not with their families at this time as well. So definitely hoping for the best for what is taking place in Gaza. It's a tremendously sad situation, and many Muslims are impacted by that, including African-American Muslims.
Well, we thank you for coming on the show today. That is Salima Suswell, CEO and founder of the brand new Black Muslim Leadership Council. Thank you again for your time today.
Thank you. Take care.
Coming up, the House just passed a bill banning TikTok. Now, that bill heads on over to the Senate. Why are lawmakers taking aim at the wildly popular social media app? That's coming up. Stick with us right here on Studio 2.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Cherry, I'm on Instagram.
Yep.
My handle is at Avi_WA, by the way. Hey, you got to self-advocate every once in a while. My Twitter handle is the same. I'm on Facebook. I'm on LinkedIn. I am on everything except for TikTok. Now, this is not a grand moral stand on my part. I'm just very old. But to hear some politicians tell it, my TikTok aversion may have saved me and my data from the grips of the Chinese Communist Party.
I am on TikTok. My handle is Cherry Gregg, by the way.
For now.
For now. But today, the House passed a bill that would require TikTok's Beijing-based parent company to divest from the social media platform. If the bill passes the Senate and the president signs it into law and TikTok refuses to divest, it would disappear from U.S. app stores. In essence, it would be banned. The bill supporters say this vigilance is necessary to protect American consumers from Chinese espionage.
But is that really true? Here to help us sort fact from fiction from Fit Check is Will Oremus. Will's a technology writer for The Washington Post and one of our favorite guests, if I may say so. Will, welcome back to Studio 2.
Hey, always good to be here. Thanks.
So, Will, lawmakers have long targeted TikTok. Now the House, with bipartisan support, has passed this bill, which is essentially an ultimatum. Tell us what exactly are they asking TikTok to do and what would happen if they don't?
That's right. The bill says that you can't distribute or host an app that's controlled by a foreign adversary. And in case it's not clear which foreign adversary they have in mind or which app, the bill actually spells out that it targets TikTok and its Chinese-owned parent company, ByteDance. It says there is one way to get out of this, which is to divest the app. And the president gets to decide whether that divestiture is qualified. So it could mean selling TikTok off to an American company. It could mean something else, but basically, TikTok, ByteDance would have a choice, either sell off TikTok or it gets banned from the U.S.
ByteDance is headquartered in Beijing, right?
That's correct.
Is the objection here simply that it's headquartered in Beijing, or does it have some sort of deeper tie to the government or the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, that's a great question. That's really gets to the heart of what the debate is here. So nobody disputes that ByteDance is based in Beijing. The question is, how much control does that give the Chinese government over TikTok? Now, technically, TikTok is a subsidiary of ByteDance. It has its headquarters in Singapore and Los Angeles. It has gone to a lot of lengths to try to show that it is independent in many ways of its parent company, ByteDance. TikTok says, look, all our data, we're working on projects so that all the data will be stored in the US. We don't share that data with ByteDance or with the Chinese government. But there are some questions about whether that's really leak-proof and how strong that firewall really is. Going back to the root issue, which is that there's a general sense that any company, any prominent company that does business in China and is based in China, is ultimately going to have to do the bidding of the Chinese Communist Party just because of the way the government works there and its relationship with businesses.
But Will, can I ask you to spell out what the theoretical threat is here? So Americans are on TikTok. They have accounts. What type of data would that theoretically give the Chinese government access to, and how would they use that in an espionage setting? Because it does seem like there would be more effective ways to spy on Americans. I'm just from a layperson's perspective here.
Yeah, I mean, theoretical is the right word there, right? I mean, there's no hard evidence that the Chinese government has ever used TikTok to spy on Americans. The theoretical threat, there's really sort of two prongs when people talk about what the threat could be. One of them is the one you mentioned. It's data privacy and data security. So when you use TikTok, you know, as far as anybody's been able to find out, TikTok has basically the same access to user data as any other app that people use. And, you know, you can control some of its access in the settings of your phone, but it can do things like use your phone. If you let it, you can use your phone's GPS to track you everywhere you go. It knows when you're opening, you know, when you've opened the app. There are actually a few types of tracking that a lot of other apps do that TikTok doesn't do. And that's because it's trying to be extra careful about the data it collects. But in general, I mean, the reality is that any app that you use regularly on your phone, with a few exceptions that are really privacy minded, has access to all kinds of data about where you are, what you're doing online, that kind of thing. And TikTok is no different in most respects. So the question is, could the Chinese government somehow get access to that data on a user? Let's say it decided that there was a particular person in the U.S. it wanted to spy on. Would one avenue be to go and you know, go into the back end of TikTok somehow and track their movements? The other, and I'll try to keep this short because I'm rambling a bit, but the other prong here is there's a separate concern that the Chinese government could somehow influence TikTok to skew the algorithm. You know, TikTok is an app where the algorithm really decides what you see at any given moment. Could there be some behind the scenes manipulation of that algorithm to advance Chinese interests? And in fact, one of the turning points in the momentum among lawmakers on Capitol Hill to pass a bill like this was apparently October 7th. There was a sense that in the wake of the Hamas attack on Israel and then Israel's military response, that on TikTok, users were getting a very anti-Israel view of the conflict. And so that is also a sort of a separate concern that people bring up.
So all of a sudden I'm seeing videos that are either anti-US or maybe pro-China. That makes sense.
Yeah. And that kind of ties to an email we got from Sammy who says, I'm not a user of TikTok, but I wouldn't have a problem with it if it used the same algorithm in the US as it does in China. As I understand, it doesn't. Am I correct? That's what Sammy asked. But are there also concerns that the way the algorithm is used could lead to more misinformation or disinformation within the U.S.?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think people should be concerned with any social media app, how the algorithm works, what type of information it's incentivizing people to create, what type of information it's amplifying, what mechanisms it has, if any, to make sure that information is true. You know, that's a broad concern with social media, and TikTok is absolutely a legitimate target of that same concern. But the thing your caller references is actually, I don't want to call it misinformation, but I think it's a bit of a misconception. And this is a talking point that's come up a lot from people who support a TikTok ban or divestiture. The idea that there's a different algorithm in China than the US. Well, yes, that's true. In fact, it's an entirely different app. So ByteDance operates an app in China that's called Douyin, and it's a separate app from TikTok. TikTok is in fact not available in China. You can't get on TikTok in China. You can get on Douyin, and Douyin has its own algorithm, its own set of rules. You know, China is a country with a heavy censorship regime, and so Douyin is heavily censored in a way that TikTok is not. So yes, they're absolutely different algorithms. They're different subsidiaries of ByteDance.
And I got to ask you a question, because what has been a reaction from the TikTok community? Because it's not just an app that kids use to do dances. And does it raise, you know, First Amendment and other concerns from this community?
Absolutely. And you know, there are 170 million, I believe, active users of TikTok in the U.S. So this is not a niche thing anymore. This is not just teenagers doing silly dances. It's used by all sorts of, you know, there's parenting TikTok communities. It's used by a wide swath of American society. But there's no denying that it is most influential among younger people, for many of whom it's their primary portal to the world, to information, to entertainment. They spend hours on it every day. People are turning out in droves to Congress, TikTok creators who rely on it to make a living, young people who spend half their free time on it are very upset about this. But interestingly, TikTok has done a campaign to mobilize people. They sent push notifications. They put a big pop-up message in the app urging people to call their representative. They asked your zip code so they would tell you which representative to call. Congress was flooded with calls last week when the House House Energy and Commerce Committee was taking up this bill. But it may have backfired because lawmakers are now saying, well, this just proves how much influence TikTok really has over its users and its willingness to manipulate those users to its own interests.
Yeah, we're telling you it's too powerful. Mm-hmm. And here's an example of it being too powerful. Interesting. Well, that is Will Oremus, technology writer for The Washington Post. Will, as always, we really appreciate the time.
Thanks for having me.
So up next,
yes,
we have sort of spying, but a different type of spying.
Yeah, you may be tempted to spy on your teens as they navigate their online lives. But the question is, Avi, should you? We talk with author Devorah Heitner about her book, Growing Up in Public. Stick with us. And by the way, get your questions in studio2@whyy.org.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. A while back, Cherry, we did a show about sharenting, which is this idea that parents might post too many pictures and stories about their little kids when the kids are too young to understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, eventually those kids do grow up.
They do.
And they start to realize what's going on. And then they start to have their own digital lives.
Teens, they are wired to find community, form identity, and you all know it, to push boundaries. But the consequences of that can be scary. And that's where our next guest comes in. Devorah Heitner talks to teens and parents who are grappling with the dilemmas posed by life online. Her newest book is called Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. Devorah Heitner, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you.
I want you to join the conversation, folks, especially if you have a teenager at home. Do you track them on social media? If you don't, how do you deal with the anxiety of not tracking them on social media or pinging their phone, their GPS? Or maybe you're a teen who's dealing with a helicopter parent, or you dealt with one when you were a teen. Would love to hear your perspective. Call us 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org.
And so, Devorah, I want to sort of set the scene here because you, Avi, we all here grew up at a time where social media wasn't a big thing.
You're saying we're old.
Yeah, we're getting older. Yeah, yeah. And you know, every mistake we made wasn't posted online. So I want you to sort of describe this world that our young people are living in that is so different. What does growing up in public look like today?
It means your parents can post those embarrassing pictures of you, that video of you doing your gymnastics routine and your friends can tease you the next day about it. It means your friends could be in the group text or on Discord or Snapchat and they could screenshot something you say there and take it out of context. That could be really embarrassing. And it means you yourself could post a video or a photo or something that later you realize doesn't reflect well on you, doesn't reflect who you see yourself as, and could cause real problems for you in terms of your reputation, your relationships, even your future opportunities.
Wow.
When I was presented with this book, I just assumed it was going to be kind of moral panicky, and it was going to be about how there's danger lurking everywhere and you have to be super vigilant. And that's not what this book is. So explain, as best you can, elevator pitch style, your philosophy from a parent's perspective about how to monitor and not monitor what your kids are doing online.
I believe we need to mentor our kids and not just monitor. If we're monitoring at all, we need to disclose that we're doing it and kind of have a plan for backing off, because we can't big brother our kids throughout their whole lives. We can't, you know, if you're location tracking your kid and they're in another state at college, that starts to be creepy, right? Yeah. And so we have to kind of work back from that and think, if I'm using these kinds of surveillance techniques on my kids at all, which maybe we shouldn't be at all doing, at what point am I going to stop? And what's my ultimate plan here? And what's my plan for my kid to figure out how they're going to live in the world with all this digital connection in a way that's going to work for them? And how could we maybe even as a whole society and community try to get away from these gotcha moments with right. kids and sharing and amplifying? Because we, like you said, we got to be young and dumb. We got to make mistakes. And that's part of normal development.
And Michelle here comments, there is no such thing as too much monitoring kids online and tracking their whereabouts. She says, stay in their business. It could save their life. And Charles comments as well that there is no such thing as too much. What is too much, Devorah?
So stay in their business is different than reading all their texts. I agree we want to be emotionally available to our kids. I agree we want to be the person they talk to. We want to be the person they ask about the difficult questions in life. We don't want them going to search that up from the internet or finding misinformation on TikTok and YouTube and not being able to check in with us. But I don't believe we can monitor our kids in a way that would keep them safe forever, because then they don't learn how to do it themselves. And what happens when we over-monitor kids as they developmentally get older and need and expect more privacy is that then they get all about hiding from us. Then it becomes, how do I use the dark web? How do I use this app my parents don't know about? And then they're actually less safe because they're in places we don't even know about or understand.
And you also point out in the book that even if they don't go further into their privacy shell, there can just be a developmental downside to over-monitoring. And I think this is, might be what a lot of parents miss, because they think, oh, my kid will hate me, but they'll get over it eventually. And that's the only downside of monitoring. But you write in the book, we do this to keep our kids safe, quote unquote, without realizing we're interrupting their process of becoming independent. Talk about how you could be stunting their development by watching them too closely.
So say you are constantly monitoring their grades, for example, and you're texting them during the school day, like, and they're sitting there in U.S. history and you're texting them about their math grade. That's incredibly disruptive to their focus. It's actually not helpful. And they need to ultimately be the one to see that grade, figure out what they're going to do about it, maybe figure out, is there a makeup assignment or something I can do? And if we let our kids outsource their executive function to us, for example, like if I look at my kids' school app and there is an app where I can look at my high school student's stuff and see every day this week if he has a quiz, what's due, if I become the person to bug him about that, am I going to do that in college? Am I going to do that at his job? At what point will I be in the Slack at his work saying, hey, honey, how's that project going?
Yeah, PowerPoint's due today. Yeah.
Not only will that undermine our relationship, but that undermines his ability to function as a human being. And so if he has to wear his dirty gym clothes because I don't remind him to wash them over the weekend and they're still in the backpack moldering and getting gross, well, you work out once in the dirty gym clothes and then you go home and you think, okay, I'm not going to do that again. I'm going to wash them.
Yeah. And it raises questions in my mind, because I think what parents really want is to have a relationship with their children where the child will share with them versus having to find out everything from sneaking around reading text messages. So how do you sort of focus on the mentoring versus the monitoring? Like, how do you sort of get to this place where you open the door for conversation, but then teach lessons along the way?
You can ask questions that are a little bit less full frontal. Instead of like, do you have any friends who are, you know, doing drugs? You could say something like, do you see kids ever acting different online than they do in person that open the door to your kids telling you some of their observations? Or do you feel like certain apps have more body pressure than other apps in terms of looking cute? Because that's always surprising. Like, some parents are more nervous about Snapchat. And I'm not here because I love Snapchat, for example. But it was interesting to hear the research that some kids found Snapchat to be less pressure than Instagram, because Snapchat doesn't emphasize sort of looking cute like a model in the same way, whereas Instagram, there can be some pressure to, you know, have that perfect photo where your hair looks really good or whatever. So both apps actually can have some pressure. I'm not trying to say one is better, just hearing from your kids, like, oh, is there an app that feels more fun to use with friends? Is there an app that feels more stressful? If you're on games, what can you do to help yourself if you find yourself getting too mad or too distracted?
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with author Devorah Heitner. Her new book is called Growing Up in Public. If you want to join this conversation all about how we should and should not monitor what our kids are doing online, especially teenagers, give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. I want to share this comment from Monique, who says, I kind of monitor them, and I also work hard to create an environment where they can talk to me. And that's what you're talking about a little bit, making sure that those lines of communication are open. But Monique says, I kind of monitor them too. So how do you advise parents about when to intervene, when to monitor more heavily if they're worried that something really serious might be going on.
I did talk to suicide prevention experts, for example, and if you believe your kid is at significant risk of self-harm, suicidality, if you know there's an issue like an eating disorder or substance abuse, that's a different scenario. And especially if you're trying to go in the front door, you're asking your kid what's going on and they're shutting you out and you think you may need a hospital bed for that child, that might be the time where, you know, their privacy isn't as important as their safety. But if your 15-year-old doesn't tell you anymore who she sits with at lunch, and she used to come home when she was 10 and told you every day who she sat with at lunch, that does not mean something is wrong. That just means she's 15. Mm. She's in a different stage developmentally. So I would take seriously worrying signs if your kid seems withdrawn or you have significant evidence that something is wrong, then yes, maybe you would violate their privacy if you have no other way to find out what's going on. But it is going to be a disruption in the relationship. So I would take very seriously trying to find out in other ways. And I think that being the person your kid can trust, even if their friend is in crisis, is important too.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times kids are dealing with vicarious crisis. It's not them. They're not on the group text all night because they're in crisis, but maybe one of their friends is going through something. And it can be very valuable if you're the adult that your kid can talk to about that.
Yeah, and Donna emails, this is a very dangerous digital environment with access to all kinds of harmful information, very unlike when we were young. Most parents I know don't monitor at all, and their kids all have anxiety and depression. She says no one is talking about over-monitoring older kids in college. So, you know, I want to, in your book, you talk about some of the issues that can arise and cause damage to relationships because of this over monitoring or what have you. Could you go through some of that? Because what it looks like on an app or what it looks like in text messages may not be the reality.
So when kids are talking about us, for example, blowing off steam, saying, oh, my dad makes me crazy, I hate my mom, it's not necessarily helpful to read that as a parent. And they may just be blowing off steam, kind of talking in a big way for their friends. Some of that is performative. So I think if we're going to read all of their texts, we may see them, you know, expressing their feelings just like we did face to face with our friends or on the phone with our friends about us. And that can lead to a lot of hurt feelings and misunderstandings with families. I understand, though, what these callers are saying is important. We do live in a time where kids can get misinformation and, you know, can see things that are really hateful, can see things that are violent, can see pornography that is nothing like what we could have seen if we found somebody's, you know, magazine in the woods or whatever. So I understand if people want to do things like filter their home internet or check their kids' phones. I do understand where that comes from. And if you start out with an 11 or a 10-year-old using a phone, and a lot of kids are getting phones in fifth grade, maybe you do say, hey, we're going to look at this together. I think the most damaging thing to do is to covertly be monitoring, not let your kid know you're there. If you are overtly monitoring, at least in the beginning, and they know you're there and you're doing it with an eye to like, I want to see that you're safe. And when I see that you've got this, I'm going to back off. That's a different scenario because that's a teaching scenario. It's not a gotcha scenario where I'm looking covertly. You're busted for something you didn't even know I was looking at. And we want to make sure our kids also know that the internet is not a great place to go for information about the toughest things in life. I mean, for example, sex and sexuality, we don't want our kids learning about that from the internet. Pornography is not a good substitute for sex ed, right? We need to teach our kids at home, make sure they have information to keep them safe about puberty, about sexuality, about relationships, about consent. That's really important.
On that point, I think the most interesting chapter in this book for me was the chapter about sexting. Because a lot of parents are scared of their kids sending sexually explicit images to one another, understandably. But you, and I'll quote you here, the uncomfortable truth is that when consensual and private, sexting can be nothing more than another form of healthy teenage sexual exploration. And then later you sort of liken how you should approach sexting to how you should approach general sex education, basically saying, it's gonna happen, so talk with them about having a healthy relationship with it. I mean, maybe explain for our listeners what your approach is to sexting, which, as you point out, is rampant.
Absolutely. Kids need to know that sharing someone's image without consent, sharing an image of themselves without consent, doing anything like that really violates someone's safety and privacy. And before all the attorneys listening call and say, I know it's illegal in Pennsylvania, it's illegal everywhere for minors to send these kinds of images. And that's a baseline. But I don't want to live in a world where two 17-year-olds in love exchange images privately and you know, experience criminal prosecution. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's a good use of our criminal justice mm-hmm. system. And I think that's incredibly harmful to and stigmatizing to those young people who I would say have not done anything wrong morally. I do think it's important to, for kids to understand and for adults to understand we're taking a huge privacy and social risk when we take an image like that and share it and put it into the world. And it can be very hard to control where that image ends up. So I'm not suggesting it's no big deal, yep. no worries. That's not what I'm saying. I am saying your kids should not feel like, and no one should feel like, if I've shared an image like that, I have no rights later.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I do have rights. And someone who shares that image without my consent is violating those rights. And that's very important mm-hmm. to understand.
So have an open conversation with them about it. Is that kind of the advice here?
And make sure that they know that even if they make a decision that they later regret or they trust someone whose trust didn't prove worthy, that they still have rights and that we still respect them and their basic humanity and that we expect them to only take actions that respect someone's basic humanity.
Instead of shaming and punishing.
Exactly. When okay. we shame and punish, we are not respecting each other's basic humanity. And if someone else has an image going around and we use a double standard, especially to shame girls and women and not boys and men, we're getting it very wrong. We need to treat all people like their basic humanity and privacy is worth championing. Mm.
And to follow up with that, kids make mistakes. I mean, like, absolutely. That's what you do in adolescence. That's why your parents are there.
Just bumping your head over and over
and over and over and over again. Yeah. Sometimes you make the same mistake more than once. And so kids are going to make mistakes online. So how do you walk through this with your young person? Maybe a picture that they didn't want, you know, to be go viral in their school, because it doesn't mean everybody sees it, but maybe within their school, or they are caught out doing something or saying something to someone that they shouldn't have said. Let's say they get in trouble for something. How do you walk them through a mistake that is permanent like that?
As a community, for example, a school community, we want to see kids deal with and repair and move forward and make restitution for their mistakes as much as possible in the moment. In other words, when we say to an 11-year-old or even a 15-year-old, this is forever, you'll never get a job, that's a problem. Even if someone has made a really big mistake, like I'm talking about a homophobic, misogynist, or racist post, something that does cause harm, I'm not saying it's no big deal. It is a big deal. They do need to repair. There should be consequences. But those consequences should be in the moment so that the offender can grow and change and get better. If we say to a 15 or even a 16 or 17-year-old, who I obviously is very different developmentally from like a 12-year-old, that you can never recover from this, you can never repair, we're actually pushing that person more to an isolated place away from society. We want them to get it right. We want them to move forward. And especially when this comes around in school communities, crucially, we also really need to support the targeted community. If a kid has posted an anti-trans post or a racist post, we need to make sure the targeted community feels safe coming to school. And so not just leaning into the perpetrator, but seeing, because we need to see that kid as like, that's the canary in the coal mine. You know what? You got one video of a kid saying a slur. Guess what? That's not the only kid in your community using that term. So we don't want to just make an example of them that's super harsh and they can't move forward from. We need to make sure they learn better. And we see ourselves also as somewhat accountable, the adults in the community, like, where did we not teach this kid well enough? How can we do better? And what can we do to make sure that the targeted community feels safe, feels seen, and understands that we care about them and love them?
That is the voice of author Devorah Heitner, who wrote Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. That's her latest book. I want to read this email from Pam and Cherry Hill, who says, I have my teen's login info for every one of his social media apps. The only app he's not allowed to have is TikTok due to rampant anti-Semitism that has only increased since October 7th. How did I handle this? We ran a Google search together, and it took less than a millisecond to bring up really horrible examples. He was legit shocked and fine with not going on TikTok after that. What do you make of that example, Devorah?
I think that kind of conversation where you're looking at something together is really important. And for parents not to say, oh, I don't know about that app. I don't understand it. Therefore, you can't be on it. But to legitimately say, here, let's look at this together and see some of the problems with it. TikTok was the most frequently quit app of teenagers I interviewed for Growing Up in Public.
No way.
A lot of kids will quit it, at least for short periods of time, because it is so immersive. And the algorithm is so darn good at figuring out what you like that kids struggle to take a break. Mm. And sometimes they'd have another goal, like a big test or an athletic event, and they'd say, okay, I'm taking this off my phone for a
week.
And
they were self-aware of
that. They were, exactly. Yeah. Many kids are more self-regulated and smart about this stuff than I think adults recognize, and more thoughtful about the impacts that it's having on their lives.
And I think to continue that part of the conversation, there are rules that kids have. And yes, you actually talk about this in the book.
This is so fascinating.
Yeah, where you discuss the art of intentional sharing and teaching young people to be more intentional. And a lot of them are intentional. Can you talk about some of the rules that we may know about, and we may not know about, and they know about that are going on the internet?
Well, yeah, a lot of us might right now, if families where kids are applying to college, might be getting that news around now. And I know a lot of my friends are hearing where their kids got into college, and kids really feel strongly about sharing that with their friends first, privately, especially among friends in the same school who've applied to the same schools, or they're supporting one another, and they don't want their parents to kind of blow it by sharing on social media before they've shared with their friends. And they're very thoughtful about how friends might feel about the news. So I found that teenagers are incredibly aware of who can see their posts in ways that sometimes as adults on Facebook or LinkedIn, we might forget, because we are new to social media compared to our kids. They kind of grew up with it.
I was so fascinated in your discussion of some of these almost, and they're not rules, but like internal sensibilities that teens have developed among themselves within these online worlds. For instance, you say kids have a reflective suspicion and resentment of being seen as too hungry and needy for attention, or thirsty. Of course, at the same time, they are very thirsty to share about themselves, which you also talk about. As a parent, I would feel so sad for my kid feeling that pressure and feeling the weight of those unwritten rules with every interaction online. How can I talk with my kid about that?
I think it's really important to ask kids what they've noticed about in their own subcultures. And of course, for everything I write about, like being a rule, and I once wrote about this for the New York Times, like kids also talk about, you know, what they share in terms of how much of their bodies they show. And yes, some of that's very different, like in high school versus middle school. So when I talk about these ideas as rules, it's not that you as parents should listen and say, oh, that's the rule. It's more like ask your kid to notice what seems like the etiquette in your community. Yeah. Just like in some people's homes, we take off our shoes and that's the culture of that home. And in other homes, we walk in with our shoes on, right? So just notice what's appropriate for your friends, ask them. And tell kids, especially in middle school, don't just block your friends because they bug you. Like maybe your rule was don't emoji, and your friend sends 90 poop emojis. Before you block them, try to tell them, hey, it bugs me when you send me 90 poop emojis. Please don't do that. And give them a chance, because, you know, if you're in sixth grade, all your friends are 20% of the time going to be annoying, even the really nice friends. And so we don't want to just block people and not give them a chance to get it right. We want to say, hey, could you change this or set a boundary?
By the way, I got to ask you this. You said every so often you should do a digital audit. And we're getting close to ending this segment. But why should you do it? And how does that work and help?
We'll be safer online and also have a better experience if we remember, wait, who am I following? And who are these people that I'm connected to? So checking in with what people can see about you, who you're connected to, what you're sharing. Am I sharing my location in this app? Do I want to be sharing it? Just checking in on all of those factors can keep you safer and keep your online experience more positive.
One more comment here from Elizabeth, who says, it's not as easy as just saying don't monitor. My child has a learning disability, and it was important that I kept track of their grades. Also, when there was bullying, he didn't want to come to me. What would be your advice to Elizabeth?
I think it's really smart that you know your own kid, and that if you're monitoring with their awareness and their knowledge, that's very different, again, than covertly monitoring. And you're working on keeping them safe in a collaborative way. So I think that every family needs to do what's right for them, and that makes a lot of sense.
Well, that is Devorah Heitner, who is a media scholar and the author of Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. And I will mention, she'll be speaking in person, not online, tonight at Thornley Middle School in Chestnut Hill at 7 o'clock. Devorah, thank you so much for the time today on Studio 2.
Thanks for the great conversation.
It was a great conversation, wasn't it, Chad?
It was.
A lot
I
to
learned
think about.
So
I am still very
much
scared of when my daughter gets to this age, but I feel a little less scared today.
And you're going to have to save this. It'll probably be an updated edition.
I will need. Devorah Heitner, I'm going to need the updated edition in about 9-10 years. Can you promise me that?
Promise.
Thank you. So that's it for our show today, Cherry. Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes produced today's program. Diana Martinez is our engineer. we're leading to something here.
Yes.
From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. And by the way, we want to welcome a new listener. Our fabulous producer, Paige Murray Bessler, just had a new baby boy.
Woo! He's growing up in public, isn't he?
Welcome to him. And our very best to the parents, Paige and Dan. We are sending love.
Love you guys.
And we will talk to you the same time tomorrow, friends.